Presentation of CITR News.
CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
Now here's your host, Andrew Longhurst.
Good evening. Thanks for being with us on this first day of February. On the program today, UBC reporters are here in studio to bring you the headlines from the UBC, UBC's student newspaper. In local news, we bring you coverage of the trial Olympic line running from Granville Island to the Olympic Village. Two streetcars have been loaned to the city of Vancouver from Brussels, Belgium, for the duration of the Winter Olympics. For this trial, and News 101 spoke to writers as well as the project engineer about this new Olympic line. Later in the program, Liz Ferris will be joining us live in studio to discuss the Copenhagen Summit this past December. She was an intern with Power Up and attended the International Summit and has also worked in the UBC Sustainability Office. Finally, Isabel Ferreras, the AMS Elections Coordinator, will be joining us live in studio to offer her thoughts on the recently held 2010 AMS elections. We'll have all this plus your weekday weather forecast coming up here this hour right here on News 101. First, joining us in the studio are Samantha Jung, Paul Bucci, and Justin McElroy to bring us the headlines from the UBC. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, this is Paul Bucci for UBC Front Page News. Here are today's headlines. The bus reroutes for the Olympics are going to be put into effect on Monday, and many of them are routes near UBC, reported TransLink's buzzer. The 25, 33, 41, 43, 49, 480, and C22 are among those to be rerouted. All these changes will expire sometime in March, and buses are expected to be back on their regular routes at that time. For more information on Olympics road closures, restricted areas, and bus reroutes, go to travelsmart2010.ca.
Blake Frederick can breathe easier. Due to a mess-up by the Elections Committee, our AMS president has not been impeached via referendum. On Friday night at the gallery, the Elections Committee announced to a packed house that only the question on impeachment of Frederick passed. The announcement was received with raucous cheering. However, the EA announced on Saturday that they mixed up the questions regarding the referendum, and in fact, question 8, should the AMS actively lobby for reduced tuition fees and increased government funding, passed instead. In other news, the university has announced their proposal to increase tuition for domestic students by 2% for next year and 4% for international students. Students can give their input and opinion on this at students.ubc.ca.
So, Justin, the AMS elections have just come to their end. Can you tell us who is our new president?
Certainly, Paul. Well, with over 6,900 voters participating in this year's elections, Bijan Amadian has been elected president. Now, Bijan is a two-time student representative of the Board of Governors, a senator, which is the highest body for academic dealings on campus for 5 years, an AMS ombudsman person, and is pretty much the most experienced student leader on campus, which was the main reason that he got elected.
What was SWIFT's major failing that allowed Bijan to get in instead of her?
Well, you're referring, of course, to Natalie Swift, who was Amadian's main rival for the presidency. And she was a forestry undergraduate society executive. And for her to win, she really needed to get out her base of supporters, which was other undergraduate societies in arts and science and engineering specifically. And she didn't do that as well as Amadian got out his base, which were predominantly the Commerce Society, grad students, of which he is one, and fraternities, which he is also a member of.
Were there any other controversial races, Justin?
Not too much this time, Paul. I mean, in all five of the executive races, it was pretty much a two-man race, except for one in which there was no candidate. And it became fairly obvious early on who would be the winners. For academic, it's Ben Capolacci, another fraternity student who was coordinator of AMS Safewalk this year. For the VP external position, which has been a controversial one due to the antics of Tim Chu this last year, Jeremy McElroy, full disclosure, my cousin, has been elected to the position. That one was a little bit closer. He won by approximately 200 votes. For the VP administration position, the person who deals most directly with the building of the new student union building, Ekaterina Dovzhenko, who has been AMS counselor for the last year, was elected handily. And finally, the VP VP Finance position, Aline Tayar, who was the Student Administrative Commission Vice Chair this last year, basically dealing with clubs, was elected to the position, and he'll be in charge of the $12 million annual budget that the AMS puts out services with.
Well, thank you very much, Justin. For Justin McElroy, Sam Jung, I'm Paul Bucci.
And thank you to those three UBC reporters for bringing us that coverage. It's time for a public service announcement, but stay with us. We have coverage of the new Olympic line up next.
CITR News is committed to providing you with in-depth Olympic coverage from an alternative perspective. As part of this coverage, we are launching a new Eyes on the Street feature, where Vancouverites will have a chance to tell their Olympic story. We want to hear your perspective on life in Vancouver during the Games. That's why we're inviting you to be CITR's Eyes on the Street this February. If you're at an event, a protest, a celebration, or even simply on the bus, tell us about it. There are three ways to file a report. Call our Eyes on the Street hotline at 604-822-5334. Email news at citr.ca or tweet CITR News. Then sit back and wait for your report to be featured on the next edition of News 101, which airs Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. right here on CITR, 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Come on out to Bob Marley's 65th birthday tribute on Wednesday, February 10th at the Royal Canadian Legion Hall. 10 pairs of free tickets will be given out to CITR listeners, so have your ears open for your free pair. That's Bob Marley's 65th birthday tribute on February 10th at the Royal Canadian Legion Hall, located on 2205 Commercial Drive. Be there, Mon!
Do you like phone sex? Well, lucky you. Wednesday, February 3rd at the Astoria, Discorder Magazine presents Sex Negatives, Phone Calls, and a special DJ set by MP40. Doors open at 9 p.m., so get your ass down to the Astoria at 769 East Hastings on February 3rd and support music, sex, and phone calls.
You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Thanks for being with us. While the new Canada line is still a novelty to many Vancouverites, the new Olympic line brings a new form of public transportation to Vancouver. The Olympic streetcar line, which opened on January 21st, will connect the Olympic Village with Granville Island. The City of Vancouver, in partnership with Bombardier Transportation, has brought two streetcars on loan from Belgium to operate for the duration of the Olympics. The city envisions the streetcar service to eventually continue through to Science World, to Chinatown, through Gastown, and to Waterfront Station. Other lines have also been proposed. News 101 reporters Janelle Chung and Kate Hughes bring us coverage of the trial Olympic line.
We're reporting live from the Granville Island station of the new Olympic line for Vancouver's 2010 streetcar. I'm Janelle Chung.
I'm Kate Hughes, and today we're going to be talking to a few people about their views and opinions of the new streetcar. Okay, hi, what's your name?
Richard.
Hi, Richard. Are you from Vancouver?
Yes.
And have you ridden on the streetcar before?
No, I haven't.
Are you excited?
Yes, a bit.
And what's brought you here today then? Why are you riding on it today?
We're just going down to Granville Island to do a little bit of shopping, and we thought we'd take this route.
Okay, and do you think that expanding the streetcar throughout the city would be a wise investment?
It'd be a great idea.
Okay, and are you planning on riding on this line anytime soon? Will you be using it often?
Oh, I think so. I work just across the street there, so I might use it on a few other days, take the streetcar to Granville Island for lunch.
Okay, that's great. Thank you very much. Enjoy the ride.
What is your name?
Susan.
And are you from Vancouver?
Half the year in Vancouver, half in Mexico.
And so have you been on the streetcar before? Is this your first time?
First time.
What brought you here today?
The streetcar and just wandering and seeing what the Olympic Village looks like. We just got into town on Thursday, so we've been away for 4 months, lots of changes.
And do you think that expanding the streetcar throughout the city would be a good investment?
Yes, I do. I do.
Do you see yourself using the streetcar often when you're in the city?
I think so, sure. Depending upon where it goes, if it's going to go all the way to Science World, if it goes down to a Stanley car, sure.
Oh, thanks so much.
Okay, hi, what's your name?
Alex.
Hi, Alex. Are you from Vancouver?
I live here, yes, I do.
Yes? And have you been on the streetcar before?
Yes, I was on the streetcar last week, too.
Last week, okay. And how was the ride for you?
Short and smooth.
Yeah, you enjoyed it?
Yes.
And what brought you here today?
Sorry, what?
What brought you here today?
We went to Granville Island to buy bagels.
Ah, okay. And will you see yourself using the streetcar often?
Yes, I live here in the neighborhood and I frequently go to Granville Island. Generally, I walk or use bicycle or take that aqua bus, and this is an extra option.
Brilliant. And do you think expanding the streetcar throughout the city would be a wise investment?
Yes, because public transit in Vancouver is generally a joke. We have SkyTrain and Canada Line that really work. Everything else is a joke. So if we expand this one, it'll be kind of contribution to the public transportation here that I think everybody would appreciate.
And are you looking forward to the Olympics?
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
Are you looking forward to the Olympics?
Yes and no, you know. We'll tell you, in 1984, I was a student and I worked in my country on Winter Olympic Games in Sarajevo. Well, then I was 24. Nowadays, I'm a little bit less in that.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for talking to us today. Have a good day.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Hi, what's your name?
My name's Craig.
Hi, and are you from Vancouver?
Born and raised.
Brilliant. And have you been on the streetcar before?
No, this is the first time.
And what brought you here today then?
Just general interest. It's something we haven't done before. I work for a railway myself, so I always have an interest in this kind of thing.
Okay. And do you think that expanding the streetcar throughout the city would be a wise investment?
Absolutely. Absolutely it is. I work for the railway that years and years ago used to be the BC Electric Railway, and the system had, the Vancouver had a very, very effective streetcar system and an interurban system at one point, and I think it was a tragedy that it was lost, and that's hurt the city ever since.
Definitely. And do you think that you'll be using this streetcar often?
Probably not this one, because I don't live in this area of the city, but if they expanded streetcar service throughout the Lower Mainland, I certainly would use it in the future.
And are you excited about the Olympics coming to Vancouver?
You know, in my own funny way, I am, actually. And just in the last few weeks, I finally started to catch the spirit of it a little bit more.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
What's your name?
Adam.
Are you from Vancouver?
Yes, I am.
Is this your first time on the streetcar?
Yes, it is.
So what brought you here to try it out?
Well, my family and I wanted to take a day off and go to Granville Island, so we thought we'd take the Canada Line, and then we heard about the streetcar, so we thought we'd try it out.
And do you think that you'll be using this often?
I hope so. It's great. It's brand new. It's great that they're utilizing this old railroad track for something.
And so currently we're actually riding the streetcar, so how do you feel? What are your first thoughts?
It's modern and new, and it's nice and clean.
It's a pretty smooth ride?
Very smooth, yes.
And do you think expanding the streetcar throughout the Lower Mainland or throughout downtown would be a good investment?
I think it would be a great investment for downtown Vancouver. Ideally, it would be great to shut down all cars from going through, build like an underground tunnel system like Montreal, and have streetcars up above.
And finally, are you excited about the Olympics?
Yes, I'm excited. I'm not going to see any events, but I'm excited.
What's your name?
My name is Yali.
Are you from Vancouver?
No, I'm from Shanghai, China.
Are you here for the games?
No. I right now I live here Yes, but you know, a few months ago, I just came here maybe for 6 months. Yes, I know this product, right? And project, and I tried twice. She likes it very much. Yes.
Yeah. So you just got off it. So what are your thoughts on how the ride is?
Awful. Great. Yeah. Yes. But is it used in the future? Yeah, I think after Olympic Games, we should use it, or it's a big waste, right? So because the Olympic Games happened last year in China,
yeah.
We did lots of projects like this, right? And right now, most of them we are using it. So that's why I think this one should be used in the future.
Yeah.
Yes. Very nice. Yes. Yes.
So are you excited for the Olympics in Vancouver?
Yes, sure. Yeah. But unfortunately, there's no snowing. This year is very warm, right? This is only one, I think, maybe a little bit pity, right? But I still feel excited.
Thank you so much.
Reporters Kate Hughes and Janelle Chung also spoke with the City of Vancouver lead engineer for the project.
So what's your name?
My name is Eric Mattel.
And what are your responsibilities with the Olympic line?
I've been managing the construction of the Olympic line for, I guess, the last couple of years. And now we're obviously in our operational phase of the project. Mm-hmm. So we're here today counting passengers and making sure that people, get whatever sort of information that they need on the project.
And it opened on which day?
January 21st. And we're going to run for 60 days till March 21st.
And how has the ridership and interest been so far?
It's been strong. We've had, on our opening day, we had, I think it was just over 6,000 riders, and we've had some steady ridership since then. People are consistently using the line to get around, so it's been really good so far.
And currently it's going from the Olympic Village to Granville Island. When is the Science World stop going to open?
Well, this project is delivered by the City of Vancouver and Bombardier. And so if the project were to move forward with sort of the city's vision for the downtown streetcar, we would need partnerships with TransLink or senior levels of government, because the city alone can't deliver the project. So in terms of building more infrastructure or having a streetcar network further to the east, that's something that we don't have a firm timeline on.
And speaking of building more infrastructure, where would the extended streetcar line go to?
Well, I mean, the city's vision for the downtown streetcar has a phase of the project that includes this as a subset of the overall network, and it will travel out to Science World, so through our new Southeast Falls Creek community to Science World, and then ultimately through Chinatown, Gastown, and out to Waterfront.
And how many people do you anticipate will be riding it during the Olympics?
It's a good question, and not one that we probably know for sure. Based on what we've seen so far, there's going to be definitely a lot of residents and a lot of tourists that are going to use the line. I'm not sure what the exact number is going to be, but it'll be interesting to find out.
And could you explain just the history of the streetcar and like where it came from and how it got here?
These modern cars, how they got here? So, again, we are partnering with Bombardier, and they've delivered two modern streetcars from Brussels, Belgium. So they get an opportunity to showcase their technology, and we get an opportunity to showcase our vision for streetcars in Vancouver.
The 90-day trial continues until March 21st. Thanks to Kate Hughes and Janelle Chung for bringing us that coverage. It's time for some public service announcements. But first we're going to talk to you about our Olympic coverage during the Winter Games. I'm here with Brad Pepink in studio. And Brad, can you just offer some thoughts about ways that we're going to engage with the community and what our coverage is going to be like?
Yeah, that's right, Andrew. Well, thanks for letting me talk. I just wanted to tell everyone that CITR News and us here at News 101, Andrew and I, we're committed to making sure that we broadcast an alternative viewpoint to our listeners. And so we're a campus and community radio station. And what we're trying to do is make sure that we engage with our community, especially during the Olympics, because we have this unprecedented event. And so what we really want, kind of the big thing thing about what CITR is that we're trying to get everyone involved. So we've launched this new campaign that we've called Eyes on the Street. So what we're hoping to do is encourage all Vancouverites to be a part of our broadcast. So that means that, let's say, Andrew, you're on the bus and you're going to an Olympic event or something, and you notice that all the signs on the bus are official media, official sponsors of the Olympics. Give us a call. Our news line is 604-822-5334, and leave a message and just say, you know, my name is Andrew, I'm going to this event, and this is what I noticed, and I think it's kind of peculiar. Mm-hmm. And what we'll be doing is we'll actually be airing those clips from our listeners on our show in an Eyes on the Street campaign.
That's right, and so that number, you can be on the bus, you can be at a protest. If you observe something that doesn't look legal to you, and it looks like some civil liberties are being trampled, give us a call, let us know. Our Eyes on the Street number is 604-822-5334. You can also tweet us at CITR News, or you can become a fan of CITR News on our Facebook fan page, which is also CITR News as well. So it's easy to find us. Also, drop us an email at news@citr.ca. So many ways to get in touch with us. Please do. We want News 101 to be your news source during the games. We want to bring you a completely independent perspective. We're not being told what runs on air. We don't have advertising and huge corporate advertisers that dictate what we air. So this is your news hour, and we want you to be actively part of it.
Yeah, and so not only are we going to be trying to engage with all of our Vancouverites, we also, what we're going to try to do is offer an alternative perspective on what's going on during the game. So we're trying to bring down some speakers who may have spoken out about the games, or who can offer opinions about the ways in which the games are affecting the city and affecting our daily lives during these 2 weeks. So make sure that you do listen to our broadcast. We're going to be starting our Olympics coverage on actually 1 week from today. And so that's on Monday the 8th. We're going to be doing a best of special of all the coverage that we've had on the past in the show, and then on Friday we'll be doing some live broadcasting with as the flame is lit in Vancouver.
And Thursday starts. The 11th, the Olympic torch will be on the UBC campus, and we're still finalizing our plans for that event. But we are hoping to be live broadcasting on site for that, and even maybe bringing you some special coverage about the actual origins of the torch relay, and talking with some guests about that. I just wanted to mention, during the Olympics, we have confirmed that the BC Civil Liberties Association will be joining us regularly on our Monday and Friday news hours to bring us about 5-minute updates to offer any comments or any observations that they may have, and that you should hear and be aware of. So that's a great opportunity to tune in and hear about civil liberties and how they're faring during the Olympics.
Mm-hmm. And that's really important, because the BCCLA, with Pivot Legal Society, they're the ones running the Legal Observer kind of sessions, that training Vancouverites to be the eyes on the street in a legal capacity. So right. We're quite excited to have that type of sanctioning.
So yeah, lots to look forward to. Do tune in.
How can people listen?
101.9 FM, CITR, on your FM dial.
And we'll also be podcasting every episode. So please check us out online as well, CITR.ca.
You can subscribe to the podcast feed through the CITR website, which is CITR.ca, as well. Again, that Eyes on the Street hotline is 604-822-5334. Get in touch with us via email, tweet us, or find us on Facebook. So thanks again for listening. We really appreciate it, and This will be an interesting time, and it's an especially important time for independent media in the city, especially here at CITR and at News 101. So we're going to go to some public service announcements, but stay with us. Next on the show, we have Liz Ferris, who attended Copenhagen as an intern with Power Up Canada. So she's going to be here live in studio talking with us. Stay tuned. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Old or New Testament?
I think the New Testament.
The question is,
Pilate. You remember Pilate from the New Testament?
Pontius Pilate. He fiddled well.
Yeah, no, well, just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, tune in every Friday afternoon, 3:30 to the Night Watch Show on CITR.
Well, find a good church. It'll help you.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The Advocacy Office provides confidential and free representation, guidance, and assistance to students engaged in conflict with UBC. We advocate for students in preparing and attending formal meetings, hearings, and appeals against the university. Specifically, our office helps students with matters of student discipline, such as cheating, collaboration, or plagiarism, assigned standing, admissions, and financial assistance. We can also assist you in appeals to decisions made by UBC Library, parking, or housing. You are not alone. We're here to help. For more information, call 822-9855 or visit the website at www.ams.ubc.ca/advocacy.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver. We're broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us. It's currently 5:28, and it's now time for your weekday weather forecast. For that, we turn to Daniel Casanova.
Thanks, Andrew. Well, don't expect to see too much sun this week, as we have a slow-moving low-pressure system headed our way. Temperatures will still be mild, but not dropping below 3 degrees this week. The normals for this period are a high of 7 and a low of 1. Here's your weekday forecast. Monday evening to the overnight, continuing periods of rain with a low of 5 degrees. For Tuesday, we'll have periods of rain with a high of 9 and a low of 4 degrees. On Wednesday, we will have a 60% chance of scattered showers, high of 9 and a low of 3. For Thursday, it will be cloudy with a 40% chance of showers, high of 9 degrees, and a low of 4. And for Friday, we will have periods of rain with a high of 10 degrees and a low of 5. Currently, it is 7 degrees with rain at YVR. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
Thank you, Daniel, and thanks to the UBC Storm Club for that weather forecast. Now we bring you special coverage of the Copenhagen Summit, which was held this past December. Liz Ferris joins me in studio to discuss the summit. She was an intern with Power Up, a Canadian NGO. She has also worked in the UB Sustainability Office. Thanks for being with us, Liz.
Sure, happy to be here.
So can you just briefly, you attended Copenhagen, and you were an intern with Power Up. Can you describe what Power Up is and how you were involved?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I guess I started out. So Power Up Canada is an organization here in Canada meant to engage the Canadian public in climate action. So really to allow us to learn as Canadians what we stand for in terms of climate change and what we can do to start making a difference. And one of the things that we talk about a lot at Power Up that I think is really important is the idea that our director, Sapora Berman, she says it took her 2 university degrees to know what she even stood for in terms of climate action. And most of us just don't have the time or the energy or the ability to do that. So really the purpose of Power Up Canada is to provide a voice to Canadians around really firm, ambitious ways to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions.
And does Power Up advocate explicit targets?
What we mostly do is we pull together anything that we think is useful in terms of good climate policy. So we do some reports. We provide information to Canadians. We bring stuff back. So while we were in Copenhagen, for example, we did a daily video blog back to Canadians, getting the information back to Canadians and getting policymakers the information that they need to know what to do to make good climate policy.
And so you obviously were there with other Canadian NGOs and environmental NGOs. How were NGOs treated at Copenhagen, and what can you describe the atmosphere?
Yeah, well, I mean, The climate summits are a really interesting scenario in general. So the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, what it does is it provides an opportunity for both party members, so those are official delegates for national organizations, countries, as well as members of civil society to come together and start a dialogue around ways in which to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, ways to deal with the challenge of climate change. So being there, the NGOs were considered a member of civil society. There are about 14,000 to 15,000 NGOs present in the actual Bella Center where the negotiations were taking place, as well as I've heard estimates of up to 40,000 people were members of civil society in Copenhagen in general during the two-week summit. So there was certainly a lot of energy and a lot of a lot of people had converged to look at, you know, what the best solutions to climate change are and how to start a dialogue in those areas.
So give us an idea of what a day at the summit looked like for you as an intern with PowerUp.
Sure, absolutely. Well, every day was a little bit different. I did a few different things. I was very interested in watching the negotiating tracks as much as possible. So sitting in on the plenary sessions when I could, as well as sitting in on the workshops, the contact groups. There was also daily meetings done. PowerUp is a member of Climate Action Network, which was a coalition of Canadian NGOs as well as NGOs across the world. I think there's about 480 NGOs in the organization. And the daily meetings were to figure out how we could be the most effective of in terms of getting the information to the policymakers that they need, as well as making sure that the people back in Canada, as well as back in countries around the world, are really getting a clear picture of what's happening during the negotiations.
Right. So this is now the third summit as part of the UNFCCC, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Was there any sense of collective malaise at the summit? And can you speak to what was going on outside of the actual Bella Center?
Sure. I mean, I think it was quite frustrating in the sense for many people who were there, both as decision makers as well as members of civil society. So the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, they have a conference of the party every year. So this was the 15th conference of the party, though it was recognized as a significant meeting. So the second time that they were coming together to agree upon a treaty or an accord or something like that. And I think that there was a lot of expectation or hope that the global community would be able to come together during those 2 weeks and by the end of that period to have a fair, ambitious, and binding agreement that would lead to a substantial reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. As you probably know, that didn't end up happening. And certainly while I was in Copenhagen, it was very apparent that there was a lot of frustration, both within inside the Bella Center as well as externally to the Bella Center.
Can you summarize for our listeners why it was such a failure? And by many accounts it is, and some even say it was a disaster, a catastrophe. Why, from your perspective, why was it such a failure?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting question and also a hard one to answer. As I mentioned, this is the 15th of a series of meetings that happen annually. And I think going into Copenhagen, even in the weeks and months before, many people realized that the groundwork hadn't exactly been laid clear enough to be able to achieve an international agreement where consensus has been reached by the global community around climate action. One of the things about the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change process that I think is really interesting is that they do rely upon consensus. So insofar as the international community is unable to meet an international consensus around how to deal with this challenge, they were unable to do that. I think in terms of the frustration or why this was seen as such a turning point is we're really starting, when we look at the science now, we're starting to recognize the gravity of the situation that we're in and the importance of reaching a fair, ambitious, and binding deal that gets us to substantial GHG emissions reductions, you know, within the next decade or so. And Copenhagen really was an opportunity that, from many accounts and many perspectives, was a missed or a lost opportunity.
So just this past Friday was the first deadline for those targets to be submitted from by every country, by every signatory. How do you want to first tell us what Canada committed to and your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's no secret to anybody who followed the negotiations that Canada's negotiating position was untenable to many and frustrating to many more. In the 1997 Kyoto Protocol negotiation, Canada committed to a 6% reduction from 1990 levels of greenhouse gas emissions by 2010. In Copenhagen, Canada was talking about the equivalent of, according to a 1990 base year, again, same as Kyoto, a 3% reduction. And this most recent target that the Canadian government has committed to as of last Friday was actually a 2% increase from 1990 levels by 2020. So as you can imagine, that target is it's moving in the wrong direction, first of all.
And so to many people, it seemed like these base years keep moving forward, and yet it's sort of we're sort of ignoring the fact that there were emissions from 1990 onward, and yet we're sort of it's convenient, and for politicians maybe it's especially convenient that the base year is creeping forward.
Absolutely, and I think that actually, I mean, that brings us back to PowerUp's message in general and why I think PowerUp is an organization, why it's an organization that I've chosen to put my support into and my time into, is the fact that most of us actually don't understand the complicated nature of base years, for example. So the government has come out and has said their GHG emissions reductions target is a 16% reduction below 2005 levels, or 2006 levels, sorry. So as the average Canadian, you think, oh, that's wonderful, that's a huge emissions reduction, but you're right that when you bring it back to a 1990 base level and start really digging through what all of these figures and what all of these facts actually mean, it actually means an absolute increase in greenhouse gas emissions in our atmosphere, which the science tells us we can't afford as a species.
I want to go back to your background and initially what drew you to being so engaged and involved in climate change policy, and especially PowerUp.
Oh, good question. I mean, that brings me back a long time ago, I guess. I did my undergrad here at UBC in the Global Resource Systems Program. And I think during that process of being in my undergrad experience and starting to learn and read more about climate change, I started to realize that climate change really actually is the defining issue of our generation. So I started sitting down and thinking that all the projections are saying by 2050, if we don't start doing something, we're going to start to see catastrophic impacts or effects of climate change and these are things that as individuals we can't even imagine. You know, sea level rise, dramatic changes in our climactic structures, so temperature, weather, storms, all these types of things. And I really realized when I was in my undergrad degree that 2050 is essentially the entire course of my adult lifetime. You know, that's my generation's call to task. So I really feel like between now and 2050, it's a huge opportunity for me and everybody who's in my generation to think about how we start to deal with some of these bigger issues.
Right. So now I want to jump back to Copenhagen now. The summit really broke down because two blocks essentially formed during the summit, and that was largely developing nations and developed industrialized countries. And so a lot of the developed countries were advocating sort of scrapping Kyoto, essentially, and a lot of developing countries were not in favor of that because some of them were exempt from binding targets. Can you speak to that dynamic and how that played out?
Sure, yeah, and I think it speaks a little bit broader to the United Nations system or the UN process in general, in the sense that really to allow any agreements to be made, there is consensus that has to be achieved among the countries. And you're absolutely right in pointing out that there really was two negotiating tracks upon the table in Copenhagen. One, a text that was leaked very early on in the negotiations, led by the Danish government, though clearly supported by Canada, the United States, Australia, that led for what was to be called the Copenhagen Accord. This would be a new climate agreement. It would be internationally binding, would include some mention of GHG emissions reductions targets, but would largely focus upon financing issues as well as adaptation. The second area where developing countries were looking at was an agreement that would move on from the Kyoto Protocol. It would keep the firm, ambitious binding targets, hopefully ramp those up over time, also include an area for mitigation. But a lot of the pieces that are part of the Kyoto Protocol, such as the Clean Development Mechanism, which, though it's had its growing pains, is the only international mechanism to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that would stay intact. But as we saw in Copenhagen, irrespective of the two-track process, at the end of the day, because there was no consensus achieved, neither track was really furthered.
Right. So recently on campus, Michael Ignatieff came to speak, and one of the questions that was posed was why he hasn't signed on to Kyoto Plus, which Greenpeace and many other NGOs have called on leaders and politicians to sign on to. Can you briefly give us a sense of why Kyoto Plus was significant and how that also plays into the two blocks at Copenhagen?
Sure. Yeah. I think the idea of Kyoto Plus is it's an attempt or an effort by the ANGO community, recognizing that there needs to be some firm text out there that that lays some clear route to how we get to GHG emissions reductions, that starts to put that out on the table. I think, though, that ultimately, at the end of the day, we need to start talking about not only how we can sign on to agreements and how we can come to consensus through documents such as Kyoto Plus, but more so how we can start doing action. To me, it's a bigger frustration to me, not that the political leaders aren't signing on or aren't agreeing on targets or whatever else, but rather it's more of a frustration that we're not starting to talk about real policy and looking at what enabling legislation in this country looks like to lead to firm greenhouse gas emissions reductions.
Right. We have a clip of Michael Ignatieff at the event here on campus, and we're just going to play it, and then I'd like to ask you a few questions about leadership in Canada and the federal government's responsibility. So we'll play that right now. This is Michael Ignatieff speaking at the Norm Theatre when he came to campus on January 15th.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming today. Like many other people in this room...
I want to thank you for coming today.
Yes, like many other students in this room and a growing number of the population, climate change is on the forefront of my mind, and I feel is the most important issue of our time. You've said that, in line with the science, we need to cut our emissions in Canada at least 80% below 1990 levels by the year 2050. These are the same targets as outlined in Kyoto Plus, something you are yet to sign. In order to believe that the Liberals will lead Canada to achieving these emission reduction targets, Canadians need to see a firm commitment made, one which includes developing strong short-term targets as well as a plan on how to achieve them. By signing Kyoto Plus, you would be making the firm commitment that Canadians need to see in order to take your words seriously. Many of your Liberal colleagues have already signed on to Kyoto Plus. Why haven't you signed on to this commitment, and are you willing to sign on to Kyoto Plus today?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Our party has a very firm and clear commitment that we need to keep global temperature from, do our part, Canada's part, to keep global temperature rising more than 2 degrees Celsius. We need to have a cap and trade system immediately. We've got to stop waiting for the United States to define Canadian climate change policy. And that's a key point here. This is an issue of Canadian sovereignty. We don't talk enough about the extent to which climate change policy is an issue of national sovereignty. Hang on. Hang on. If you ask me a question, wait for the answer. You'll get an answer. I'm here to give you an answer. My sense is that I'm not going to let a Kyoto Plus petition be the test of whether I've got a credible climate change policy. I think this movement has had an enormously productive effect on public opinion. But I'm a public official. My responsibility is to create a credible climate change policy for a party in opposition that hopes to be in government. And that's what I plan to do. That's what I'm saying. We need to have a cap-and-trade system. We need to get it started now. We need to stop waiting for the United States. We need to stop waiting for Barack Obama and Waxman Markey to give us our climate change policy. We need to develop it in Canada. The three provinces have already started with some cap-and-trade activity. We need federal leadership. We need to make the tar sands a sustainable industry. We need to get its water use down. We need to have protection of our boreal forest. We need to have protection of marine-sensitive areas. I have a very, very broad vision of what Canada needs to meet the environmental challenge. The Conservatives have not met any of these challenges, and I propose to do so. So that's the answer I'm going to give to the question. Thank you. Let's go to the next one.
So, Liz, can you offer your thoughts on that for Mr. Ignatieff?
Yeah, I mean, I think he spoke very well in the sense that all of the rhetoric is there as it should be. You know, he talks about making the tar sands a sustainable industry. He talks about marine-sensitive areas. He talks about the boreal forest, the need for cap and trade, not aligning with the United States. So I think all of the touch points of the conversation are there. But to me,
why is he so? Why won't he sign on to it?
I think it's sort of like I was saying earlier. I'm not sure that I actually necessarily see the utility of these agreements that commit us to certain targets without the action behind it. And actually, for me, as somebody who's looking to see firm climate action, I actually get more frustrated when politicians are yes people who say, yes, I will do it, yes, I'll sign on, in the same way that as a country we signed on to Kyoto about 12 years ago, but then we did absolutely nothing to meet those targets or to meet those agreements. Potentially, I think the reason why he's not signing on to it is because he knows he doesn't have a clear plan for how to achieve it. For me, the bigger question that as the public we need to be asking our decision makers is, okay, if you can't sign on to it because you don't have a plan, how are you going to make a plan? You know, how are we going to start? You're going to talk about all the rhetoric of tar sands and marine-sensitive ecosystems, boreal forests. But for me, the bigger question that we need to be asking our decision makers is where do we start to develop a plan so that we can sign on to some of these commitments? And we can know that when we sign on to them, we're going to be able to achieve them.
We also have a clip from, there was a Greenpeace protest that occurred at Mr. Ignatieff's visit to the Norm Theater here at UBC, and we're going to play that clip specifically about the tar sands, and he references making the tar sands sustainable and that it's not in the national interest to shut that down. We'll play that clip, and then I briefly want to discuss those comments as well and the tar sands.
Before this demonstrated started, that one of the key things about politics, one of the key things about Canada, is we can pick and choose which facts we like. The tar sands are a fact of our national life. We have one of the largest proven carbon reserves, oil reserves in the world. The question is, what do we do to make it sustainable, right? I think I've got it here, right?
So, And that was Michael Ignatieff speaking at the Norm Theater. So, Liz, back to you. Can we, from your background and your involvement with Power Up, can the tar sands really be sustainable? Is it a sustainable enterprise?
I mean, I think there's no doubt in anyone's mind that to achieve the types and the level of GHG emissions reductions that we're anticipating or wanting to be achieving in the time frame that we want to be achieving them, that means absolutely we need to be stopping producing more greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere. And, you know, that largely leads us to some questions of, okay, well, if we can't be producing more greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere, can we really be affording to burn fossil fuels? I think, though, it's not quite as simple as saying tomorrow, let's just shut down all fossil fuels. The fact of the matter is that as we've learned in our energy system, fossil fuels are the best source of energy that we have in terms of energy density per weight and amount of energy produced per density. So we have to think about how we transition our entire economy towards a zero carbon future. And I think that's something that at Power Up I've learned a lot about and we're starting to talk about. So more the question becomes not necessarily how do we make the tar sands sustainable, but rather how do we start transitioning into a sustainable economy and really looking at what does that look like.
Do you think Michael Ignatieff would be a good prime minister in terms of taking leadership on reducing emissions? And does a comment like this give you hope about what he's really willing to do in terms of emissions reductions?
You know, I think the fact of the matter is that any politician, no matter what party they're in or what they believe, they have an extremely huge challenge in front of them in terms of looking towards implementing good, firm, fair, ambitious climate policy in Canada. The feasibility of implementing a lot of the rhetoric that's on the table right now, as we're witnessing, is quite difficult. And to bring it back to the question of the tar sands, the idea that we can just shut those down tomorrow, which from a climate perspective is exactly what we need, is actually very difficult for the hundreds of thousands of people that enterprise employees. So whether or not, you know, do I think he is the right man for the job? Maybe he's talking about some of the right things. You know, he's got all the right touch points on the table. For me, the real question, and it has to be for all leaders, whether it's him or anyone else who puts their hat into the ring to say that they think they have a plan, is where does the plan hit the road? What does it start looking like? And where do we start to see absolute greenhouse gas emissions reductions right away?
Well, great. I think we'll leave it at that. Thank you, Liz. Thanks for joining us in studio. Really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
And that was Liz Ferris. She served as an intern in Copenhagen for Power Up, which is a Canadian NGO. And it's now time for a break, but we're going to be right back with Isabel Ferreras. She was the AMS elections coordinator, and she's going to be speaking with us about the past 2010 AMS elections that were held this past week. Stay with us. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
23rd, beginning at sunset in Montreal, broadcasting live on your local campus and community radio station.
Sometimes we get that instant homelessness. We didn't expect to be homeless, and we find ourselves on the street because of an eviction or a notice.
Canada's largest talk show on poverty and homelessness.
We have a mayor who compared poor people to pigeons publicly and said that if you stop feeding them, they'll go away.
The 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, broadcasting February 23rd to 24th. A 14-hour live radio show from frozen street corners across Canada. Call in live, join the discussion.
Our demand from the federal government is $2 billion a year for social housing units across Canada. That'll just help us to start catching up to the 15 years that we've lost in building social housing in this country. It's really a glaring example of the negligence of the government.
Visit www.ckut.ca for more info.
The Homelessness Marathon will be broadcasting live from Vancouver on Tuesday, February 23rd at 8 p.m. as CITR 101.9 FM partners with CJSF 90.1 FM and Co-op 102.7 FM to bring you an hour of interviews and stories of how the 2010 Olympics are affecting homelessness in Vancouver. Visit CITR.ca for more information. This is News 101, and the current time is 5:55. It's been a busy several weeks over at the AMS as the 2010 AMS elections closed this past Friday. To discuss the 2010 AMS elections and offer her thoughts, Isabel Ferreras, the AMS elections coordinator, joins us live in studio. Thanks for being with us, Isabel.
Thanks a lot.
Can you just give us sort of initial your afterthoughts about the election and how the campaigns ran, and from your point of view, how it went this year.
I think the elections went fantastically this year, and of course I'm not just saying this for my own ego, but I do feel that the elections were scandal-free this year, which was a major difference from years past. Everything was a little more organized because I was hired earlier, and because candidates were really willing to, you know, step up, be mature, and run effective campaigns without having to break major rules, and that was really beneficial to the overall effect of the elections. I think we also made the elections more interesting to students, probably because of the events that have happened in the AMS in the past year, and also because we sort of did a more event-driven elections season this year rather than just having debates.
Great. And so can you tell us what happened with the referendum to impeach Blake Frederick?
Yes. The elections committee, we made a slight mistake in what we thought had passed. We thought that the referendum for impeaching Blake had passed, but we were mistaken and corrected the error the next morning to state that that one did not pass. It did not reach quorum. But the one that did reach quorum was the referendum to lobby for lower tuition and higher government funding.
So we've got these two issues. One is that many argue that the position of VP, the office of VP External, and the president are too autonomous from council and have been under Timothy Chu and Blake Frederick. And now with this referendum that is basically yes to lobbying for reduced tuition fees and increasing government funding, is there a likelihood that these things will come up again in future councils where maybe certain offices are acting more autonomous from council than students feel they should be or other council members feel they should be?
The way I feel about it is that question that did pass, it will have to be up to the interpretation of the external office as it's their position position to do so. I do think it'll come up in future council meetings because some people have said that the wording is not entirely clear and doesn't provide a specific mandate, but that's up to the external office to figure out.
Okay. And in your opinion, why didn't the $5 voter turnout increasing engagement, the engagement referendum pass?
I think students feel that first of all, I think that voters weren't necessarily informed of the wording of the question, and they might have just said, oh, okay, look, it's a fee. I don't want to take that. But I think some students, at least from what I've heard, they feel that they shouldn't be roped into voting just because they're obligated to financially. And while it is a small fee, I understand that I can sympathize with students who have a problem with it.
Okay. And what would you do differently next year? And what would you say to future elections coordinators?
I would do the following. I would not hold paper ballot stations for the Christian colleges. Instead, I would find a way to integrate them onto the online system to be even more cost efficient than we were this year. I would organize the debates earlier and make them more visible, and I would also make them more interactive.
And so there was an exit poll for voting in the 2010 AMS elections, which was about the stations, the voting stations around campus. What will that information be used for?
The information will be used directly for both mine and my chief returning officer's transition reports. We believe that we should have some really detailed, informative ones so that whoever serves our positions next year, because it probably won't be us, that they will be able to get, you know, hit the ground running and just run an even more effective election and see where they can cut costs.
Did people use the on-campus voting stations?
They did. I think it was mostly minor, and some people felt that they were too public and that they'd rather vote in private, which is great to hear, but it was just sort of a transition period from, you know, having an entire day of 12 ballot stations with all paper ballots to, we couldn't just go to nothing. We needed some visibility there, so yeah.
Do you know the breakdown generally about how many votes came in throughout the voting period? Is it mainly weighted towards the end of the voting period?
Yes, we had almost 2,000 votes on just the last day, and okay. We had about 1,600 on the first day, and then the 3 days in between were smaller voter turnout.
Okay, well, finally, can you just give us the numbers? What was the final turnout?
The final turnout was 6,925 students out of 46,438, which is 14.9%, which is...
Compared to last year, what is it?
That's 401 more voters than last year. I do not know how many students were registered last year, so I can't say if there's a percentage difference or not, but I have heard that it's one of the highest turnouts there's been in decades, so that's
okay,
really exciting to hear.
Well. 14% it is. Well, thanks, Isabel, for joining us in studio. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's our program for Monday, February 1st, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter @CITRNews and subscribe to our podcast at www.citr.ca.
It's 14.9.
Brad Pepping produced this radio program. For more news, join us this Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Andrew Longhurst. From the entire news team here at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for this side of Monday, right here on 101.9 FM, CITR.